Those are some of the questions I'll be asking in this forum from the BBC World Service. I'm Rajan Datar, and I'm joined today by three experts on the late Roman Empire. They are Sarah E. Bond, Associate Professor of History at the University of Iowa in the USA, Megan McAvoy, Lecturer in Byzantine Studies at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, and Peter Heather, Professor of Medieval History at King's College London, here in the UK. Welcome to you all. Let's start by looking at what happened before we sift through why it happened. So, Sarah Bond, when was the Roman Empire at its height?
It certainly depends on what you mean by its height. If we're talking about geographically, then this is under the Emperor Trajan, and about 117 CE is the furthest extent of the Roman Empire in terms of expansion. Then we get a lot of contraction thereafter. Between about 100 and 150 CE, and certainly before the Antonine Plague in 165, was probably the greatest extent of the Roman Empire in terms of the economy and the geography and the power of Rome, was right in that first half of the second century CE, under Trajan up to Marcus Aurelius until the Antonine Plague.
Because there was a period, wasn't there, when they talk about the five good emperors.
The five good emperors are considered such in large part because they were chosen by the Senate. They are choosing the best successors. These are emperors that are considered to be much better at ruling and not just able to rule because they were born into the role. Nerva, Antoninus Pius, Trajan, Marcus Aurelius, and also Hadrian before Marcus Aurelius.
So there was a peak, a period when the Roman Empire was in very good shape, as it were. But Megan McAvoy, I think some people would be unaware that the empire essentially had two emperors for a long period of time, and at one point, even four leaders. So tell me, why did the Roman Empire split in two, with, I think, a base in Rome and another in Constantinople?
Well, it's really not until the end of the 4th century that we have a clear picture of an Eastern and Western Roman Empire. It is true that there are times of multiple emperors before this, and when we think about four emperors, most commonly we're thinking of Diocletian and the Tetrarchy at the end of the 3rd century. But the city of Constantinople itself is founded by Constantine I in 324 AD. It's really a refoundation. There was already a city on the site by the name of Byzantium, but Constantine renames the city after himself. But in the previous few decades, emperors, and there had been multiple emperors ruling concurrently, these emperors had already been using multiple cities around the empire as imperial headquarters, and they're using cities that are close to the empire's frontiers. So the city of Rome is actually really a long way from the empire's borders at this time. And in an era where defensive wars are often fought, other cities become more suitable bases for campaigning emperors. And Constantinople has many strategic advantages. It provides easy access to the eastern frontiers of the empire, where Rome faces her great enemy. This is the other superpower of the era, Sasanian Iran. And it provides easy access to the Danubian frontier. It's on trade routes. It's also easily defensible. But after Constantine dies in 337, Constantinople still isn't really used as a permanent imperial headquarters until the end of the 4th century. And this is under a new dynasty, the Theodosians, who reside in the city from the 380s onwards. And 395 is really the year when we most commonly start to talk about a clearly Eastern and Western Roman Empire with an Eastern and a Western emperor. And this is because in the year 395, the emperor Theodosius I dies. He leaves the empire to his two sons. The elder son, Arcadius, rules as Eastern emperor from Constantinople, and the younger son, Honorius, rules as Western emperor from Italy.
So we have two big centres of power. So Peter Heather, let's just focus on the Rome-based empire, because it had borders. And tell me, what was happening outside those borders that was to become so important?
You've got a huge social, economic and political revolution unfolding around the fringes of the Roman Empire in the early centuries AD. In the early Roman period, you have a huge number of very small units in the Germanic world. I mean, Tacitus mentions maybe 60. from the Rhine to eastern Poland. So they're all small, they're all separate. This is replaced by a much smaller number of larger confederations. What's also playing into that story and part of it is a very large phenomenon of migration. At the eastern end of Rome's European frontiers, down on the Danube, the Gothic confederations that form in the later 3rd and 4th century have a substantial core of migrants at the heart of them. The Alemanni that come to power in the upper Rhine region, they're also migrants from a more central part of Germany, having moved towards the frontier area. I think what's basically going on is that the frontier area becomes a center of wealth, where the maximum trade is going on with the Roman Empire. Wealth gets generated there, and it sucks people in.
And the kind of tribes, if you like, that we're talking about, the names like the Goths, the Visigoths, the Vandals, who were they? What were they like? And were they assimilated into Roman society?
They certainly know about the Roman world. They trade with it. They have quite complicated diplomatic relations with it. They provide contingents for its armies by the 4th century when those armies are fighting big campaigns. So Goths, for instance, go to the Persian front. You know, they tramp thousands of miles across now Turkey to fight against Persia on at least 4 occasions in the later 3rd and 4th centuries. So they're part of a sort of Roman imperial system, but they are certainly junior subordinated clients at this point on the other side of the frontier.
Is the general term for them all then, is it barbarians? Is that the word that the Romans would call them all, or what?
The Romans called everyone barbarians. The Romans even called the Persians barbarians. And, of course, civilization grew up in Iran and Iraq, which is the center of Persian imperial power in this period and for thousands of years before. Barbarian is derived from a Greek derogative term. I mean, the modern equivalent would be very nasty and we wouldn't use it on air.
And in terms, Sarah, of diverse groups, I mean, we've heard that there's pressure from the northern border, but obviously the Roman Empire does spread all the way around the Mediterranean. So in terms of feeling a threat, if you like, was that being felt everywhere?
If we're looking at the 4th century CE, we're seeing North Africa, for instance, as a very stable part of the Roman Empire that has a very flourishing economy up until the period when the Vandals begin to come in the 430s into Africa. We have the grain dole that is going to Constantinople and also to Rome, and the grain is coming from Roman Egypt, but also from these very large latifundia farms that are all through North Africa that are also producing olive oil and olives and beautiful pottery and also wine at the same time. So you have to be very specific and not look at the Roman Empire as simply a monolith. I think it's sometimes something that's very difficult for people. When we say the Roman Empire, we speak of it as one entity, when in fact the provinces had very different cultural, economic, and social flavors to them.
And Megan, I'm interested in the dynamic between the Eastern and the Western empires. I mean, were they cooperating all the time? Were they rivals at all? What was going on there?
I don't really see them as rivals. The late historian Sir Fergus Miller described them rather as twin empires. So two Roman empires, an Eastern and a Western empire, but that are connected. So they have their own governments, their own administrations, their own military establishments, and obviously their own emperors. But for public appearances, they're united in purpose. So coinage issued in the Eastern Roman Empire is valid in the West. Western emperors mint for Eastern emperors and vice versa. Legislation issued by an emperor in one part of the empire is valid in the other part. So there is a very public unity being presented, and they don't control the same territory. So although there could at times be some squabbling over borders and some tensions between Eastern and Western emperors, more often there are important moments of cooperation, particularly across the course of the 5th century. So across the 5th century, when the West begins to really get into trouble, there are some major campaigns launched by the Eastern Roman government at great expense to the Eastern Roman Empire to try and assist the West. And this happens on multiple occasions. And even as late as 468, so within a decade of what we call the fall of Rome, there's a massive naval expedition launched by the Eastern Roman government to try to retake Roman North Africa once again. And this is a hugely expensive campaign. And if it had succeeded, would have been a tremendous boost to Western imperial fortunes. Unfortunately, it was a complete catastrophe. But what it tells us is that the Eastern Roman government was really committed to trying to assist the West through this period of crisis.
Let's go back to the 4th century. And Peter, one of the milestones in Rome's disintegration is said to be the Battle of Adrianople in 378, which is in Western Turkey, today's Western Turkey, when the empire was very far from its height. Tell me, why was that battle so important?
I think it has two levels of significance. The deepest level of significance is the run-up. What events make this happen? Because what... We see a new level of migratory phenomena in the later 4th and early 5th century. Very specific to a constrained time frame. It's not things that we've seen before. We see sudden pulses of very large numbers of people on the move into Roman territory. And these two Gothic groups who are fighting Valens at Hadrianople, they are the first of these. The more immediate significance is that by virtue of some kind of extraordinary fluke, because this is not what normally happened, the Goths win, and they win an extraordinarily decisive victory. They are ancestral with a few more recruits, well, probably plenty more recruits thrown in, to what will become the Visigoths of southern Gaul and Spanish fame. For the first time that we know about, the Roman Empire is forced to tolerate the autonomous existence of a large force of outsiders within its own frontiers.
So it's a kind of concession, really, isn't it? And a major concession at that. And Sarah, the other factor in all of this was religion and how that was changing across the empire. And tell me about why that was significant.
We get Christianity really thriving during the course of the 4th century, but it should be recognized that there were lots of flavors of Christianity at this time. That, for instance, the son of Constantine, Constantius II, was an Arian Christian who followed the teachings of a man named Arius. But we have a lot of the quote-unquote barbarians following Arian Christianity coming into the empire. But we have Nicene Christianity, which follows the Nicene Creed, is going to be the one that eventually wins out as the most influential type of Christianity that is made official by the Edict of Thessalonica in 380. Over the course of the late 4th century into the early 5th century, we see this championing of Nicene Christianity and of the creation of legislation that is going to try and stamp out a lot of the traditional gods of Rome. And a lot of the traditional temples then are going to be turned into churches.
So it's interesting as well, because you obviously mentioned that the barbarians themselves were Christians, but of a different kind of brand, if you like. So Megan, I mean, does that mean that there was actually rivalry of division within Christianity too, which again was significant?
There are a lot of different flavors of Christianity in late antiquity, as Sarah has said. And there are quite a few church councils across the 5th century in particular, where different views are espoused or denounced by different bishops and sometimes by emperors as well. This can create tension. A lot of the non-Roman groups moving into Roman territory, almost all of them are Christian. I think the Huns and early on the Franks are the only exceptions. But they're not the same brand of Christianity as that espoused by most Roman emperors or the Roman aristocracy. And I suppose this can contribute as well to the sense of their otherness. Having said that, there are a lot of non-Romans serving in the Roman military, as Peter has highlighted, and this goes on throughout the 5th century. And some of them rise to very high command, to supreme command below the emperor, in fact, to the role of Magister Militum. And some of these men are Arian Christians as well. So it's not necessarily a problem, I think.
We'll come back to that. But Peter, let's just look at the 5th century then, leading up to 476 AD. Tell me, what were the main differences in the Roman Empire when we compare it with the empire at its apex, at its peak centuries before?
There's kind of a myth out there that the end of the empire is a relatively peaceful affair, that kind of Romans allow themselves to drift into non-existence. But that doesn't work when you look at the details of the historical narrative, starting, of course, with Hadrianople. These confederations move onto Roman soil to get away from the Huns, and then in the course of the 5th century, by dint of military expansion, take over larger chunks of Roman provincial territory. And that's actually a kind of knife at the jugular of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is a very simple, in some ways, structure. It's a largely agricultural economy. It doesn't generate very large surpluses. What the empire does is tax those agricultural assets to maintain its armies. And three quarters, in all probability, there or thereabouts, of those tax revenues are spent on the army. So when intrusive outsiders are able to start annexing chunks of provincial territory, then that starts to eat away at the fiscal equation that keeps the empire in being. And eventually we see the remaining last emperors simply running out of the tax revenues that they need to keep their armies in being.
Sarah, let's look at 476, the actual year. Why do people hold that year to be so important at all?
This is the year we have the deposition of the last Roman emperor of the West, commonly known as Romulus Augustulus, but his actual original surname was just Augustus, and he got the diminutive, which is Augustulus or Little Augustus, because he was still a child when he came to power. And after Julius Nepos, who was the previous Western Roman emperor from Italy, we have the elevation of Romulus Augustulus in 475. He only rules for a little bit less than a year before we have a German soldier who will rule over what we call the Ostrogoths, named Odoacer, and he is going to overthrow and establish himself as the king of Italy. And so many people, Peter included, have used the year 476 to mark the fall of Rome. I think that this is a lot of debate, because what we're talking about is a political changeover. And when we say Rome, we actually are talking about a much larger complex organism that is not simply defined by the Western Roman Empire and its political leadership. Just because we have a changeover here does not necessarily mean that all of Rome has fallen, but that has been the traditional date. Even since the 6th century, this was used as a date for the fall of Rome, at least in the West. So 476 is very handy. Other people have said that it was 410, which is the year that Rome gets sacked for the first time in almost exactly 800 years by Alaric and the Goths. Other people have said that it's 1453, which is the year that Constantinople is taken and the city of Constantinople falls. But there are a number of dates, and 476 is just a very popular one.
Because also, I mean, presumably at the same time, Megan, we're talking about the Eastern Roman Empire in Constantinople. How stable was that in 476?
Well, the Eastern Roman Empire does have its own problems at this point in time, but it remains wealthier, much wealthier than the West. It doesn't suffer from the massive territorial losses that the West does in this era. And as Peter has highlighted, this is a really significant factor. In terms of internal politics, the East is in some trouble as well in the 470s. So the emperor of the time, a man called Zeno, was actually deposed himself in 475, and his throne was claimed by his brother-in-law. Zeno manages to stage a comeback in 476 and reclaim his throne, but his preoccupation with his own problems made it less likely he would intervene in Western affairs, as other Eastern emperors before him has done. But also, just following up on some of what Sarah has said, although Romulus Augustulus is always described as the last emperor of the West, he isn't really. He had only been emperor for about a year. He's never recognized as emperor by the Eastern Roman Empire, so he's never seen as a legitimate Western emperor. And in becoming emperor, he and those supporting him had deposed a man by the name of Iulius Nepos. But Iulius Nepos was still alive. He had fled Rome. He was living in Dalmatia. Now, Zeno, as I said, isn't really in a position to do much about this, but he actually does write to Odovica and say, look, Nepos should be your emperor, actually. Zeno just doesn't back that up with military support. So Odovica can sort of nominally accept this. He actually mints coins for Nepos as the Western Roman emperor until Nepos himself dies in 480. And this idea of 476 as the moment of a fall really is an idea that originates in the Eastern Roman Empire in the 6th century. There's a chronicler by the name of Marcellinus Comes. He's a bureaucrat writing in Constantinople. And he's the one who actually says this was the moment when Romulus Augustulus was deposed.
So somewhat annoyingly, nothing is quite as simple as the history textbooks tell us.
Absolutely not.
But OK, but in the grand scheme of things, Rome does fall. And the question we should really ask now is, you know, was that avoidable? Could the Romans see it coming? What changed and what stayed the same? Who was most affected? And we'll be exploring all of that and what the experience of Rome tells us about other empires in the second part of this episode of The Forum from the BBC World Service in a couple of minutes.
Distribution of BBC World Service in the US is supported by HomeAdvisor, helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can now see upfront pricing, book appointments, and pay for over 100 projects with the HomeAdvisor app. And Magoosh, online test prep for GRE, GMAT, ACT, and SAT. Staying at home is a great time to prepare for something new with self-guided lessons and support. Magoosh.com.
COVID-19 has been described as a referendum on the ideas that brought America to a difficult but defining moment. Writers Ibram X. Kendi and Ed Young have been taking a long look at the two emergencies facing the country, racial injustice and a paralyzing pandemic. How did it come to this? We'll speak to both of them next time on 1A. This morning at 10, here on 91.5 WBEZ.
Still to come on The Forum with me, Rajan Datta. As we discovered in part one, Rome, the so-called Eternal City, wasn't so eternal after all, and its great overweening empire collapsed. But what really led to its downfall? Was it a clash of cultures, a series of bad decisions and poor leadership, or was it a more organic type of disintegration, and perhaps even inevitable? And what can we learn from it today? I'm back with my three guest experts after the news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. 3 days of national mourning have begun in Lebanon following the devastating explosion in the capital Beirut on Tuesday. At least 135 people died in the blast. The search for the missing continues as anger mounts at the failures of Lebanon's political elite. The Trump presidential campaign has been forced to take down a video posted on Facebook and Twitter. In an interview clip, Mr. Trump said that children were almost immune to COVID-19. Facebook said the post violated its policies. The Bank of England says it now expects the recession caused by coronavirus in Britain to be less deep than previously expected, but for the recovery to take longer. The bank predicted that output would not return to pre-COVID levels until the end of next year. Australia is imposing further internal travel restrictions from midnight on Thursday to try to suppress coronavirus infections. New South Wales will force anyone arriving from Victoria to spend 2 weeks in hotel quarantine. At least 8 COVID patients have died in a fire in western India that broke out at a private hospital in Ahmedabad. The blaze started after an employee's personal protection kit caught fire. United Nations research has found that some Turkish men have been doing more than 5 times their previous amount of housework during the pandemic. But the average figure for men is still just over an hour a day, much less than the average for women. Toyota, the world's biggest car maker, has seen its quarterly profits nearly wiped out by coronavirus. Its operating profits dropped 98% in the period from April to June. And the Japanese city of Hiroshima has been marking the 75th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack. BBC News.
Welcome back to The Forum from the BBC World Service. I'm Rajan Datar, and today we're exploring the fall of Rome, when the last of the Roman emperors in the West was deposed by a Germanic king in 476 AD. I'm with Megan McAvoy, Peter Heather and Sarah E. Bond. And if you're interested in other extraordinary periods in history, you'll find quite a few podcasts on them in the Civilizations and Wonders collection on the Forum website. Right, so before the break, we were looking at the events leading up to the fall of Rome. Now let's turn to the causes, the underlying causes. Now, did Rome collapse under its own weight, or because of Christianity, or migration, or something else, or all of the above? And for most people, did life anyway go on as normal, oblivious to what was happening at the top? So Peter, tell me, what did the Romans think was going wrong for them? Who were the warning voices, and what were they saying?
A lot of empires like to think they're in charge of their own affairs. So they talk about moral collapse, failing to preserve the ancient virtues. And you certainly get a strong line of that in Roman accounts. If you're failing to deal with the barbarian problem, that's because you're not doing it properly. So there's a lot of tendency in Roman sources to gaze at the navel, to think about what are we doing wrong here. I mean, I don't think it has to go out of existence. We were talking before about possible different dates for the fall of Rome. To my mind, the really serious moment is the defeat of that great expedition that Megan mentioned, the one from Constantinople to try and reconquer North Africa in 468. If that wins and you put North Africa back into the tax base of the Western Empire, then the Western Empire is given a new lease of life. It wouldn't cease to exist. That it's that sort of ultimate defeat there that puts it on this trajectory to non-existence as a political entity. But again, as Sarah said, that doesn't mean that there aren't lots of elements of Roman culture and some Roman social and institutional structures that survived the political collapse. We're talking about the end of a monolithic political empire. That's really what we're talking about.
And Sarah, in that sense, is there also then a problem, a fundamental problem in a way, with the concept of empire, that in a sense it has to keep on growing or it dies?
I don't think that you have to expand in order to be an empire, but I think that the modern idea is that continued geographic expansion is what is needed for an empire to be sustained. And I guess I would argue that we have to kind of see that the Roman Empire could have continued even without having the same political superstructure if they had a much more stabilized tax base. And there was hyperinflation that was causing a lot of economic strife, particularly within the third and then early fourth centuries.
So it's largely economic in that sense. But I'm interested, Megan, because you said earlier on that the two empires, the East and West, were largely supportive of each other, yet, you know, the Eastern one did carry on, and for a lot longer. So were the leaders there, the emperors there, better at their jobs than those in the West?
I wouldn't say they're necessarily better at their jobs. I think you could say that they were having an easier time of it in terms of external threats and territorial losses in the 5th century. So they're facing fewer external threats. It's a period of relative peace for the Eastern Empire with its great enemy, Sasanian Persia. So they're not fighting long-sustained wars on their eastern frontier, which is sometimes the case for the Eastern Empire. They do face invasions from some foreign groups, including Attila and the Huns, but those invasions are not as serious. They don't result in large-scale losses of territory, and the East has more resources. It maintains more resources for paying off enemies like this. And a major factor, really, I think, in the East faring better than the West comes back to what Peter's been saying, is this ability to maintain their territories and hence their revenue.
Let's look at another cause for the fall, which has possibly gone out of favour, and that is the great historian Edward Gibbon, who many a schoolchild would know about and read the book The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in the Past. Where did he lay the blame, Peter, and was he right?
He's putting the blame, well, in part on Christians, but I always think that's part of his kind of rationalist, anti-Christian, late 18th century vibe. He does mention barbarians, but what's not available to him is the evidence that actually barbarians have changed. I mean, in the sort of bigger context is this very broad and fundamental remaking of the structures of non-Roman society. And he has the same kind of value judgment that's in the Roman sources themselves, namely that if you have good people in charge, you get good outcomes. And if you have bad people in charge, you get bad outcomes. I think much more, I mean, what Megan basically told you is that Constantinople was lucky. Its key revenue producing areas are Western Turkey, Egypt, Syria, Palestine, and no one is settling in large armed groups on those territories in the 5th century, whereas the West, quite the contrary, its best bits are bits of northern Italy, southern France, Spain and North Africa, and those are being annexed. So I've spent most of my life arguing against Gibbon's view, and I imagine I'll go to my grave doing the same.
And Sarah, let's put it another way as well. I mean, are we looking at history in a rather skewed way? Because, yes, we can look at the elites and the leadership, but for most people living in the areas that were once controlled by Rome, how much were their lives really changing or disappearing?
If you're looking at Visigothic Spain, for instance, we see that there's a legal code that treats Romans differently than Visigoths. But if we're looking at places like the 5th century following the Vandal invasion, of course, St. Augustine would say there's a huge change. But if we're looking at places like Italy under the Ostrogoths, there is a transition to a different type of Christianity, to an Arian Christianity. But overall, a lot of Ostrogothic Italy stays very consistent. And in fact, there's a lot of similarities between many of the Ostrogothic kings and the previous Roman emperors. So it really depends on where you are and the experience that you would have.
But Megan, I also want to kind of drill down into your average person, your average family in that time in the empire. I mean, they were just like peasants, right? I mean, they were just basically relying on agriculture and just, you know, just getting enough food to get by. Is that fair?
Yes, I mean, the vast majority of the population of the Roman Empire are agricultural based, and I do wonder how obvious the political changes at the center of power really are if you're in that situation. I think particularly what happens in 476 may not look very different to somebody like that than what's been happening for the last 20 years in the West, because in the past 21 years, there have been 9 different emperors, and there have been periods also of years without emperors in the West during this era as well.
And your view, Peter?
It is absolutely right that in the moments of transition, you might not notice very much. But we do see a fundamental systems change into the post-Roman world on all kinds of levels. You know, the Roman state structure taxed heavily to maintain a professional army. Professional armies disappear, taxation declines massively. This, you might think, is straightforwardly a good thing. But actually, in an agricultural economy, taxation is often a stimulus. Certainly, the archaeological materials suggest a substantial population decline overall, and a very substantial simplification of economic exchange across most of the Roman, post-Roman West, barring maybe Sicily, bits of North Africa and southern Italy around Rome, by the later 6th century. When agriculture simplifies, this has strong effects on the urban base. Worst in Britain, where towns completely disappear and don't start to reappear until the 9th century.
We're getting towards the end now, but I want to return to the point, Sarah, that you're making, which is that, I mean, in a sense, are we right to even look at this as being one big decline and fall, or was it, you know, just steps into from one kind of type of civilization to another, you know, from the Roman model, if you like, to of the early empire to having lots of local rulers and having the Middle Ages, and, you know, I mean, is that the better way of looking at it?
Absolutely. I think that there was a fragmentation and then a transition. And I don't fully ascribe to this idea that everybody is simply transitioning to a different cultural entity and that we have lost Rome completely. I think that, you know, Rome continues to live on in art and in a lot of different ways through religion and social superstructures that is still very important. I don't think it's one large catastrophe like, say, a huge earthquake. I think it's rather just something that is protracted over hundreds of years.
And in terms of the values and the culture, I mean, for a start off, a lot of that was preserved and carried on in the East, Megan, wasn't it? So, I mean, again, are we wrong to just say that Roman culture and died? Because certainly in the East, it carried on thriving.
Yes, it really does. I mean, the Eastern Roman Empire really is the continuing Roman Empire, and it endures right down to the fall of Constantinople in 1453, as Sarah mentioned earlier. Of course, it has changed a lot by that point, but we'd expect any empire to change over such a long period. And right throughout its history, the Eastern Roman Empire, which modern historians now tend to call the Byzantine Empire, but the Eastern Roman Empire continues to view itself and refer to itself as Roman. The emperors ruling from Constantinople call themselves Roman, and so do their enemies as well in the East. And Roman law and administrative structure and Roman cultural habits continue in the East. Emperors still continue to use the Latin language as the language of government, at least through the 6th century. And it's from the Eastern Roman Empire that some of the great legacies of Rome passed down to us, such as Roman law. And this is actually the basis for many European legal systems today.
We've got to the end, but I do want to ask you this important big question, really, which is that what lessons do we learn from the fall of Rome? I mean, if we make any parallels with the decline of subsequent empires or of recent history, what would you say? Let me go to you first, Sarah.
One thing we can learn is that when Valens tries to settle, he makes a lot of promises that then are not carried out. I think one thing that we can learn is about the treatment of people who are seen as migrants and immigrants coming into the empire. Far from the narrative that we should be fearful, especially in the United States, of individuals coming from places like Mexico and coming into the United States, oftentimes the fall of Rome is used as a model for arguing against immigration. And what I'm saying is, if we look at the year 376 and the treaties, we see that the Romans greatly abused many of these barbarians that were coming into the empire and then being used as soldiers. They didn't follow through on a lot of the promises of sanctuary and protection that were given to them. And so perhaps the lesson from the fall of Rome is being more accepting of immigrants and of those migrating into other countries.
What do you say to that, Peter?
I like Sarah's approach, and I think one thing to learn from the Rome is not to be an arrogant pain in the rear end that thinks you have the right to dominate the entire planet. That would do very well. I agree with Sarah on that. Empires tend to have this kind of cultural arrogance and dominating arrogance, which doesn't tend to lead to good outcomes. But I think the reason it doesn't lead to good outcomes is perhaps the more serious point, and that is that empires are systems. They're not things. The Roman Empire of the 4th century is not the same as the Roman Empire of the 1st century BC or AD. It's a system of transformation that has worked transformations within its own territories. But it also transforms the world around it. And that's the thing that I see when I look at the Roman world, when I look at first millennium AD European history more generally. What I see is actually an early precursor to modern globalization, where the kinds of economic, political, and cultural linkages that form between metropolitan imperial centers and the world around them transform the world around them and transform them fundamentally. This is why I look to the non-Roman world for the undermining of the Roman imperial system. And the lesson, I think, is that's there is that when that world around you transforms, it's not unrelated to Sarah's point, then recognize it and don't try and pretend that the empire still continues. Remake your relationships with the world that you've transformed on a more positive basis and move away from that kind of direct confrontation.
And would you look at any subsequent empires and their fall? I mean, let's bring up the British Empire, for example, and say that are there any parallels there?
Yes, to my mind, it's very similar. Actually, it screamed at me from the Roman sources that the Goths of the 4th century were nothing like the Germanic groups mentioned in Tacitus. And when you looked at the archaeological evidence, it kind of thumped you on the nose that a great part of that transformation had been affected by the relationship with the Roman Empire. And over 300 years. I mean, we're talking a long period, like the existence of the British Empire in certain places. And I think that there is a general effect that empires start by kind of ransacking the economies around them, but this prompts reactions amongst the populations that are originally exploited. They reorganize themselves. In the end, they force the empire to treat them more as equals. And in the end, that power balance on which the original imperial relationships form is itself overturned.
Thank you. And lastly to you, Megan, what lessons can be learned, do you think?
What we've really all been talking a lot about across the course of the program is that history is really simple or straightforward. And it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to sort of pinpoint a year or put a label on a development and say this is a key moment of major change. But for those actually living through them, that might be much less obvious.
But can we learn anything from the experience of Rome and the Roman Empire?
Of course. I mean, so much that it's very hard to actually cover it in the amount of time we've got. But the points that Peter and Sarah have both made in terms of thinking about the presence of migrants on borders has a huge amount of relevance to the way we look in at the world today. And the fall of Rome is one of those, or is used as one of those events by many different factions today as an example of how things can all go wrong. And I don't think we should be using it in that way. I think we can think about the ways in which Rome dealt with migrants and dealt with foreign peoples, and we can learn from that.
A very suitable point to finish. Sadly, that is all that we have time for on the forum today. My thanks to Peter Heather, to Sarah E. Bond, and to Megan McAvoy. And thank you all for listening.